Good afternoon. Daryl Waz and Michaela Rivera appearing on behalf of the appellant Owens Corning. Your Honors, in 1943, the United States Supreme Court issued an opinion which stated what was probably obvious but has been repeated by that court, this court, the Colorado Supreme Court, and every other court in this country ever since. And that concept and the express statement in that case, which is U.S. v. Miller, was that the purpose of just compensation, the right of owners, their constitutional entitlement, is to be put in the same pecuniary position after a taking by the government as they would have been if the taking had never occurred. That is the simple proposition that has to be defended and that is implicated by this case, because it is beyond dispute, and in fact was not disputed in the trial court, that because of the taking, in this case, the partial taking of Owens Corning's property, and only because of that partial taking, this owner incurred, not might incur, not hypothetically may incur, but has incurred approximately $13 million of costs to cure the damage that was caused by the taking, to restore the functionality of its property that it had before the taking. That's not even being argued. The essence of this dispute is whether that's just too bad for Owens Corning, whether it simply has to bear that damage because this is a public taking and because of the application of a rule that the trial court called the business profits rule. Because 3 weeks before a two-week jury trial was to start on this case, the trial court, ruling on motions in limine that had been pending for months, said that the opinion of just compensation of an appraiser named Wayne Huntsberger, one of the most distinguished, if not the most distinguished appraiser in the state of Colorado, would not be allowed. He could not testify that just compensation included those damages that had been caused by the taking. And the reason the damages were caused was because of the 13 acres that Owens Corning has operated and that has operated for one thing for over 70 years, a manufacturing plant that makes basically every shingle on every house in an eight-state region.
Counsel, was your client in any way prevented from asserting either, you know, in any pleadings or again through its expert, alternative defenses, alternative theories of recovery? And was the trial court incorrect in suggesting that, you know, this was basically a judgment call or, you know, a gamble that your expert took in relying on a particular methodology to value the losses?
Yeah, I think that the trial court judge acted as if he was ruling on an issue of evidence, an issue of sort of reliability of an expert, of expert testimony. But the issue in the case below was not what is the value of Owens Corning's property in the after condition and exactly how did the appraiser get there. The appraiser simply had to establish through his opinion of just compensation that the $13 million in damages that had been incurred by Owens Corning was less than the diminution in value to their property that occurred if you don't cure the damages. It was a mitigation of damages issue that the trial court really had in front of it, that Owens Corning did have its massive impact on its property. It simply could not function after the taking as a manufacturing facility, making what it had made for 70 years. That's beyond dispute. It couldn't do it. They had to have the ability to manage, store, and process their inventory, or it simply isn't a manufacturing facility anymore.
Mr. Waz, pardon me for interrupting you, but I think I understand the approach you have here requires us to determine in the first instance that this is a special and unique use.
It does require acceptance of the proposition that this could be what an appraisal methodology is called a special purpose property, which the trial court accepted. It said Mr. Huntsberger can give his opinion that this is a special purpose property.
But apparently the court, and again, I apologize for interrupting,
no,
but apparently the court came to the conclusion that this was not a special purpose property.
Respectfully disagree, Your Honor. What the court said, I'm dubious about whether it really is a special purpose property, but that's a triable issue. Huntsberger's opinion that it is special purpose will go to the jury. That's part of the combined order that is on appeal. My point is he did not do what is logically consistent with that finding. He said Mr. Huntsberger can testify that in the before condition, before the taking, this property was worth $53 billion. That goes to the jury. That whole opinion is based on the property being special purpose and being valued because of the use that this owner put it to, which was the manufacture of these shingles. That was all going to go to the jury. And if that goes to the jury, then saying at the same time, but you cannot say the property's been damaged by this taking and that the owner can mitigate its damages by paying $13 million to start a new ancillary facility 7 miles away and 36 trucks every night move the inventory from the production facility to the ancillary facility, and that's the cost of having it. So it's logically inconsistent for the trial court to say, well, maybe a special purpose property, but you can't show your damages as if it's a special purpose property. And that's fundamentally what the trial court did that was wrong.
Oh, Mr. Oz, pardon me. As I understand it, though, the before condition valuation was based on the cost method, which is one of the three recognized methodologies.
That's right.
And then the after valuation was based on this productivity, which I think Mr. Huntsberger testified was a variant of the cost, although in all honesty, from his deposition, I didn't quite understand all of that. So two questions. One, how does that affect your analysis? And two, as I went through the record, I could not find Mr. Huntsberger's entire deposition. If I missed it, can you guys point me to where it is in the record?
If it is in the record, we can point it to you. I can't do it as I stand here.
Fair
but
enough.
But
okay.
I can. First of all, just to set the stage, I mean, what the owner has to prove in the condemnation trial was that it suffered damages and that those damages were less than the diminution in value. It didn't have to prove what the after condition value was. All it really had to prove was that that number was bigger than the cost to cure. And that's a limitation on the owner's rights. It's just a mitigation. We have to prove that we mitigated our damages. That was part of our burden. Mr. Huntsberger said, when you look at what this property did in the before condition, it had a certain kind of productivity. And the professional literature is cited in the briefs, it's in the record, that the number one aspect of valuation, a special purpose property, a manufacturing facility, which is a traditional kind of special purpose property, which is nothing this court or the Colorado Supreme Court has ever addressed. How do you value these properties? Mr. Huntsberger went to the professional literature and it said the number one element of value is productivity. What does the property produce? What is it worth? What does it make? But that's no different than any other valuation proceeding in any eminent domain case. If we were valuing an office building, we'd be talking about how much do the tenants pay? How much does the security cost for this building? What expenses are related to maintenance of the building? All of these elements of the financial performance of the real estate would be obvious, and they occur in every condemnation case where the income approach to value is used. And all Mr. Huntsberger did is say, I'm looking at some of the economic elements of the productivity of this property to reach this conclusion, which is the only thing that he needed to be able to say. If you don't solve the problem, if you don't cure the damages, if you can't keep using this property as this special purpose property, then it's worth exactly what RTD said it was worth, $7.5 million, which is a tiny fraction of the diminution in value and half of what it costs to repair the damages. So that number, that concept that the damage to the property was profoundly greater than the damages being sought, wasn't really in dispute. The court quibbled with how Mr. Huntsberger did it, but Mr. Huntsberger did it in a way that is justified by the professional literature, supported by a PhD economist in real estate economics at the University of Denver. And to say he can't even give that opinion, I think, was error. Then that was the court making what it said was an evidentiary ruling, but it really wasn't. It was a substantive ruling that you can't collect these damages. You can't restore this special purpose property to its pre-taking use if it costs money. That's what the court was really saying. That's a legal issue That's not an evidentiary ruling, and that's fundamentally what the trial court did.
How would you propose that the trial court, it seemed to me that the trial court was attempting to reconcile, you know, the testimony that was being offered with its understanding of eminent domain law, and specifically that you don't get a loss that's attributable to the production, you know, the business loss rule. So how would you propose that the trial court, on the one hand, apply law applicable to eminent domain, and on the other hand, assess the proposed expert's testimony?
Well, I'll say it quickly, then I'll reserve the balance of my time. I do think that what the appropriate remedy here is that this case should be remanded for the trial to go forward and for Mr. Hunsberger to be able to give his opinions. But what the trial court did, and what this court would do if you affirm that decision, is basically say, if you have a special purpose property in Colorado and it's damaged, you cannot, as a matter of substantive law, collect the costs to cure the damage, to maintain the special purpose. That's the fundamental decision the trial court made. And if this court makes that decision, it will be the only court anywhere that has ever said that. I reserve the balance of my time.
May it please the court, my name is Rich Rodriguez. I represent the Regional Transportation District. You should affirm the trial court's decisions in this case because the trial court did not abuse its discretion, and its decisions are supported by nearly a century of Colorado precedent. You should reject Owens Corning's position because it asked you to substitute your judgment for the trial court and establish new law and policy, which is better left for the legislature. I want to address first a couple of questions that your honors asked. Judge Fox, you asked Mr. Waz whether there was anything that the trial court did that prevented Owens Corning from offering a different valuation method, and the answer is no. In fact, the court specifically said in its combined order, even assuming that this property is a special purpose property, and even assuming that substitute valuation methodology can be employed and should be employed, Mr. Hunsberger's analysis ultimately was denied and rejected because it violated the business profits rule. In fact, much of the briefing at the trial court level was with respect to what were the supposed other valuation methods for a special purpose property. We submitted to the court with support from cases outside of Colorado that when courts talk about referring to other means to derive just compensation, it's referring to the other income approaches. And this is where it's important to recognize and understand, when you look at these cases, the genesis from these cases, what the law was in those particular jurisdictions when they were adopted. For instance, Colorado, up until the mid-70s, used the sales comparison approach as really the only method of valuation, or at least it was the preferred method of valuation. And then the Colorado Supreme Court, in the Berglund-Churn case, issued a decision that said, no, just compensation is, in some respects, a flexibility approach, and so you also have to look at other means of valuing the property, which would include the income approach and the cost approach. And we cited in our briefs, if you look at the cases, when they're talking about the other means, they're referring to the cost and the income approaches. Owens Corning could not find for you a single case in any jurisdiction where the court applied anything even remotely similar to what Mr. Hunsberg did in this case. In fact, most of the cases that they cite that you should use the cost approach. And the reason they say you should use the cost approach as the fallback is because in some senses, the cost approach really doesn't reflect the true fair market value of the property. It sets the upper limit. Because what the courts have said is when you look at that, you look at that as well, maybe in the marketplace, somebody might spend money to replace or reproduce the structure, but that's going to be the highest limit. There's nothing out there that allows the approach that Mr. Hunsberger did. And then Judge Dunn, you had asked the question whether what Mr. Hunsberger actually did. And he didn't do a variant of the cost approach. What he did was he did the cost approach in the before condition. And the cost approach, as you probably know, is where you estimate the reproduction or replacement costs of improvements on the property. You deduct all forms of depreciation from those costs, and then you add the land value. And Mr. Huntsberger, in this case, concluded under the cost approach that the property was worth about $52 million in the before condition. Our appraiser disagreed with both Mr. Huntsberger's use of the cost approach and his finding that the property was special purpose. Our appraiser used both the sales comparison approach and the cost approach. But what Mr. Huntsberger did in the after condition is he said that he had an analysis from Owens Corning that took for a single year, and this is important, for 2011, they took a single year of Owens Corning sales for that specific site and then estimated what the gross margins were for those sales for that single year, and then considered that, well, if we don't cure this problem that RTD allegedly caused, we will have to ship in shingles from our sister plants in other states, and that's going to have an impact on those gross margins to the tune of 47%. And so he took that 47% and he applied what he says was an adjustment to the cost approach. There is no such thing as an adjustment to the cost approach. As we said in our briefs, an adjustment is something, it's a tool that is used in the sales comparison approach. And let me give you an example. Let's say that the subject property was a commercial property on a corner lot with a high traffic volume. And the appraiser is using the comparable sales approach, and he finds a sale a couple miles away that is on an interior lot with no traffic volume. And so what the appraiser does is he takes that comparable and he adjusts it upward to match the subject property's condition. And that will give him sort of apples to apples so the appraiser can determine what is the true value of the property. There's nothing in the literature, there's nothing in any case law that Owens Corning can cite to you that says it's proper to do an adjustment to the cost approach.
Well, what if the jury found that it indeed was a special purpose property?
If the jury found that it was a special purpose property, it's our position that Mr. Huntsberger's opinion still would have not been allowed, because you have to have an objective appraisal methodology that's been approved in the courts by the Appraisal Institute that measures objective value, objective loss, and not a analysis that's focused on business profits.
Well, his analysis doesn't necessarily depend upon business profits. It depends upon the cost it represented to Owens Corning to replace valuable spatial purpose property.
I disagree, Your Honor, respectfully, and the reason is, as we said in our briefs, you don't get to the cost to cure analysis until the landowner can prove that there's been a diminution in objective property value. And that's where Owens Corning fell down in this case, is the only evidence it had as to a diminution in value was an opinion from Mr. Huntsberger that the value had diminished $24 million based on its gross margin analysis.
And isn't that relevant for purposes of letting the jury decide that question?
It's not, Your Honor, because the issue of whether the appraiser has adopted an approach that violates the business profits rule is an issue for the court. It's not an issue for the jury.
So it's not a matter of discretion. We could determine as a matter of law that the judge was wrong about that issue.
I submit, Your Honor, that the standard is an abuse of discretion. We've cited in the briefs the cases that support that. The judge was ruling on this in the full context of an in limine motion that was supported by not only extensive briefing, but all of the appraisal reports that were submitted in the case.
Well, Mr. Waz has responded, and I'd be interested in your rejoinder. He has responded that what the judge did wasn't make a ruling of evidence. He made a substantive decision of law about this.
He made a substantive decision whether the business profits rule applied. That is correct. But he based that decision based on the evidentiary record in front of him. I do want to talk briefly about the business profits rule, because the court, it's important that the court understand why Mr. Huntsberger's analysis fits within that rule. In the simplest form, the rule prohibits any value testimony that's based upon the profits of business being conducted on land. And why is that the case? It's because the courts have held that the business is not being condemned, and the success or failure of business is dependent on many factors that are unrelated to real estate. This principle also includes the prohibition of testimony based on the loss of goodwill, and it specifically includes the preclusion of evidence of gross sales. And that's significant, and I refer you to the Cook case in the briefs. And in the Cook case, which the Supreme Court decided in 1974, in that case, what happened is really in many ways similar to what Mr. Huntsberger tried to do here. The Denver Urban Renewal Authority had condemned some property that was used for a retail sporting goods store. And what the owner in that case did, and it was owner-occupied, it wasn't rental property, and what the owner did is the owner said, well, I'm going to use the income approach, which is an accepted approach, but I'm going to use a percentage of my gross sales for this particular business as the income multiplier, and then follow the approach through to come up with a value, of an opinion of value. And what the Supreme Court said is that gross sales are barred by the business profits rule because those, like profits themselves, are really dependent upon the entrepreneurial skill or the business person and not on the land or not on the property. And if you look at what Mr. Huntsberger did in this case, he did the exact same thing. His gross margin analysis was based upon Owens Corning's gross sales. But instead of using those gross sales in the income approach like the appraiser did in Cook, he used them in his variant or an adjustment to the cost approach. Gross profits or gross sales is gross sales, whether you use it in the income approach or whether you use it in the cost approach.
Counsel, how do you differentiate this case from the City of Englewood versus Denver Waste Transfer case, where it seems to me that the court did allow or approved of the introduction of evidence that went beyond just the before and after value? They actually took into account what the useful, productive use of the property was going to be.
Yes, Your Honor. The Denver Waste Transfer case. That case is it's very unique. I will give you that. What happened in the case was Englewood was condemning a vacant piece of property that the owner was proposing to build at some point in the future a waste transfer facility. The issue for valuation purposes was what was the value of a PUD, which is a planned unit development, it's a type of zoning, and a permit for that facility. The owner's appraiser used what's referred to as the land residual method. The land residual method is a method that's approved by the appraisal of institute, the appraisal of real estate appraisers. There's actually chapters on it in the book on how you apply this method. Like there are chapters for the sales comparison approach, like there are chapters for the income and the cost approach. And what the appraiser did in that case for the owner is he used what's called a net income multiplier. It's not really important what that is, but what's important is under the land residual approach, that multiplier is market derived. It's derived under a factor that is extracted from the market. And so what the Court of Appeals said is there's a criteria, there's a method that's been adopted, the criteria has been followed, the method itself is based on the marketplace, it's based on objective data, and the PUD and permit were to some extent tied to the land. It didn't address the issue whether the income in that case was related to land from the land itself or from the business. It simply said that the PUD and permit was tied to the land. But significantly in that case, and the court said it in two places, what was important to its decision is the owner's appraiser in that case had subtracted elements of business value. And so what you have in that case is you have an appraiser who said, all right, I need an alternate method of valuation, in my opinion. And so I'm going to look to what has been approved by the appraisal institute. I'm going to follow their methodology to a T. Their methodology clearly is based on the market, not the subjective whims of this particular owner, and I'm going to subtract business value. Well, compare that to what Mr. Huntsberger did. Mr. Huntsberger didn't adopt and use an approach that's approved by the appraisal institute. He didn't follow any criteria set forth in the treatises. He didn't do anything based on the extraction of market data. He took data from Owens Corning's business operations. And in that particular instance, he did not subtract any business value. He simply said 47% is the hit they're taking to their margins, 47% is what I think the value would be in the residue. I think what's important in my last remaining moments here is I want you to understand that there was nothing in the record where there was any evidence that Owens Corning presented that prospective purchasers would consider Owens Corning's margins in determining what it would pay for this site. There was no evidence in the record that any prospective purchaser, whether for asphalt shingle operations or productions or any other purpose, would use the same business model that Owens Corning used to run its facility. There was no evidence in the record to support that a asphalt shingle company would implement any of the cures that Owens Corning implemented for to continue asphalt production use on that property or any other property.
Mr. Rodriguez, can you point us to any authority that excludes the special, excludes the business profit rule in a special use case or special purpose case?
I can't at this time, but in my brief, I think on pages 33 and 34, there are a number of cases from outside of Colorado where I refer to courts were excluding. The one that jumps to mind is an appraiser similar to Mr. Hunsberger tried to say that, well, this you have a manufacturing plant that has certain efficiency value, and therefore I'm going to consider that the operations income and valuing that property. And the court said, no, we're not looking at efficiency value. We're looking at, that's a business-related issue. We're looking at the value of the land and the improvements.
And it's your contention that Owens Corning could have done this through one of the three approved methodologies, either through costs or comparable sales.
Yes.
And Mr. Rothrile used two of those.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rodriguez. Mr. Wallace, you have about 351 remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, just on the question of what's in the record, and I appreciate the fact that we have a huge record here. It starts with 14 motions in limine, two of which are granted, others denied, and lots of exhibits and depositions and reports. But it is, in fact, in the record. Page 44 of Mr. Hunterberger's appraisal report, he says specifically, anybody who bought this property would have to do the same cure that Owens Corning had to do to maintain the functionality of the property. That is in the record, and he would have testified to that if he had been permitted to do so. I want to start with the Berglund Churn case because I think it's interesting that Mr. Rodriguez started there. Berglund Churn is primarily noteworthy for the fact that the Supreme Court said there, and it's reiterated ever since, that we have an expansive rule of evidence in eminent domain cases. And that emanates from the constitutional basis of this process and the recognition that the experts who testify in eminent domain cases generally are much more knowledgeable about what they're testifying about than in lots of other cases where experts appear. These are real estate appraisers who are subject to constraints and licensing and professional literature that's been cited over and over by this court as authoritative. And what Mr. Hunsberger did here is nothing extraordinary. I want to talk just a little bit about what the business profits rule is and then what the trial court could have done instead of what it did do. The business profits rule is just a logical and obvious rule that says the government doesn't have to pay for something it doesn't take. Government can take businesses, and in some cases it has taken businesses. And when it takes a business, it pays for the business. But the problem with real estate eminent domain cases, which is 95% of them, is that most land makes money for somebody. And unless you're talking about a vacant piece of property, or maybe a farm in 1892, most land has to be considered in light of its economic productivity. That's the way it's valued by everybody. What money can it make? And so there's this tension between owners who want to say, well, I run a business on my land, so I want the government to pay for my business because my business is on my land. And the law says if they're not taking your business, they don't have to pay for your business. But what the law also unequivocally says is if the government damages your land, you're not prohibited from showing that the value of your land is tied to what you economically do on the land. It is in every case. And I think RTD wanted to act like something really special and unusual was happening here with an owner coming in and saying, we want to look at the productivity of the land. What do we make? What do we sell it for? How much money can be made with this land? But Denver Waste is the right case to look at because this court in Denver Waste Transfer took a completely hypothetical business, a business that existed only in the imagination of lawyers and appraisers, and on paper, and hardly even on paper,
And they said, in that case, the jury can hear how much money will it cost to get this business up and running? How much money will it make? How much will it cost to run it? What's the capitalization rate to draw back that stream of income from this hypothetical business? And in this case, the trial court, instead of saying, Mr. Huntsberger can't even talk about just compensation, it could have said, I've got a problem with the way he came to this after condition valuation. Maybe his way of looking at whether that was a bigger number than the cost to cure wasn't perfect. So let's give him a chance to do a slightly amended report. Or let's let him testify to other information in his report that was already there, from which the jury could have said, yes, the diminution in value is a multiple of the damages. So that number could go before the jury, and Owens Corning could have had its day in court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Woz. Thank you again, Mr. Rodriguez. Thanks to both counsel for your excellent argument.